and thank you so much for joining me today. This is Ellen Kamai, Natural Nurse at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse, and we love to hear from you. And every week we bring you another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network. That's Gary Null's network. And you can listen every Tuesday at 10 to 11 a.m. live and also call in your questions during the show. Or you can visit anytime by going to the archives at prn.fm. Go down to Natural Nurse under the show list. And our last few shows will be archived there. And so you and or your friends and family anywhere in the world can get that information. And today we have as our guest Mr. Bob Oley. Bob Oley is a Lyme and tick-borne disease prevention expert and public health consultant. He has been involved in public health work for more than 30 years. Early in his career, he served as Director of Environmental Health for the city of Stamford, Connecticut, and more recently has worked in Pennsylvania and the surrounding areas as a public health consultant specializing in tick-borne disease prevention. An important aspect of his consulting work involves advising families and businesses on how to make their properties safer from ticks and on what personal protection measures can be taken to safeguard family members and workers. Oley conducts educational seminars on Lyme disease and tick-borne disease with a focus on prevention and has spoken before diverse groups such as the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation and the Montgomery County Public Works Association, to name a few. Bob has also appeared on several radio shows, which he is joining us today on our radio show, The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And to find out more, you can go to TDB. That's T as in Thomas, D as in dog, B as in boy, TDB, alliance.org. So thank you so much for joining us today, Bob.
It's my pleasure being on the show, Ellen. Thank you very much for having me. And I've got one little potential problem here. I think the battery on my phone is wearing down. Can I give you another number that we can connect on?
At this point, we're in the middle of the show, so, you know, perhaps we'll do that during the break if possible.
Okay.
And you can call in perhaps at that time and speak to the engineers. Okay, let's go back in time and see what got you interested in these kinds of things, such as tick-borne illness?
Ellen, I myself have been infected with tick-borne disease, with Lyme disease. I probably was infected 25, 30 years ago when I was living in Connecticut. And didn't know it at the outset, and then I, being a public health specialist and having an education in graduate degree in public health, I've always been involved in public health work. So I've always had an interest in the topic of tick-borne diseases and Lyme disease, and when I myself came down with Lyme disease, I particularly became more involved. And I have become very much involved in the last 3 or 4 years here in Pennsylvania.
Well, certainly, so many people are motivated to look into health issues because of their own personal experience or a family experience.
Ellen,
that'll definitely get your attention with Lyme disease.
Yeah, it definitely will. And Lyme disease is a disease that can cause a lot of turmoil in families. It's a great economic cost to some families, and it will definitely get your attention. And when people have Lyme disease, and Lyme disease is a very difficult disease to treat, you tend to go online. You tend to try to get as much information about it, especially when you don't seem to be getting better or the symptoms seem to be staying around much longer than you would like. So it can be a drain on one's family life. It can be a drain on many, very many aspects of one's life. And that's why people become more and more involved in tick-borne diseases and particularly Lyme disease.
Well, let's talk about the organization you set up, which is TBD Alliance. So that stands for Tick-Borne Disease Alliance. What made you set up this particular organization, and what is its function?
Ellen, I did not set it up. I actually am on the Medical Advisory Board of the Tick-Borne Disease Alliance. The Tick-Borne Disease Alliance is a national nonprofit, and it's dedicated to raising public awareness through education about tick-borne diseases, Lyme disease. It promotes advocacy, and it supports initiatives to find a cure for tick-borne diseases, as well as to try to find a better diagnostic testing for the disease, Lyme disease and tick-borne disease. It's a great organization. It's been around for many years, and I have been involved with the Tick-Borne Disease Alliance now for the last couple of years.
Oh, so they were already set up when you got involved with them?
They were.
Okay. And what is their goal or stated function?
Their goal is really to... again, it's a nonprofit, and they try to raise public awareness about tick-borne diseases, and they promote advocacy on tick-borne diseases, and they raise money to support initiatives to try to find a cure for tick-borne diseases, and to kind of come up with better testing for the tick-borne diseases.
Yeah, well, that's good, better testing, because that is a problem. I have so many patients that come in. They want to get a dark field analysis, and in a dark field analysis, I actually take a drop of blood and put it on a dark field microscope, and we can see a lot of things in the blood. And one of the things we can see is various kinds of bacteria. You cannot see viruses because they are too small. But in terms of bacteria, you can see three different varieties, for instance. We can see rod-form bacilli. We can see round, which are called coxiforms. People have that sometimes with strep throat. And then we can clearly see the spirochetal forms, such as the kind of infectious agent that causes Lyme disease. You can actually see them in the blood sometimes. Sometimes you see them, sometimes you don't. And yet that is not considered a positive diagnosis, even if you do see them.
That's correct.
So what are some of the ways that people can get a positive diagnosis? Because one problem is that unless you get a medically recognized positive diagnosis, then insurance won't pay for any treatment.
Right, and that's a very, very big problem. Because the testing is so very poor for Lyme disease as well as the other tick-borne diseases,
I'm thinking that perhaps we did lose Bob because he said he was having a phone malfunction. So we're going to go to a break right now and play a natural medicine chest, and then perhaps he can try to reconnect with our engineer. So we'll be right back with more right here on the Natural Nurse.
On this edition
Dr.
of the
Z.
Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss jojoba, the miracle plant of the desert.
Jojoba is spelled J-O-J-O-B-A, but is pronounced according to its Spanish origins. The jojoba plant grows in the American Southwest and the Sonoran Desert in Mexico. The jojoba is a large bush-like plant resembling mistletoe. It can reach a height of 15 feet and can live from 100 to 200 years. The Sonoran Indians have used the oil pressed from the jojoba beans for centuries. Father Juniper Serra, founder of 21 missions in California, noted in the early 1700s that the local Indians were using jojoba oil for treating sores, cuts, bruises, burns, and as a diet supplement, to soothe skin from sun and wind burns, as a cooking oil, and even as a beverage.
The importance of jojoba as a cash crop was proclaimed in 1935. But it was not until 1974, when the killing of sperm whales was banned, that the government began to study jojoba oil in depth as a substitute for whale oil. The National Academy of Sciences concluded, jojoba oil has a radically different chemical structure than any other known oil. Most oils break down or turn rancid. Jojoba, on the other hand, is hypoallergenic, non-toxic, never turns rancid, and does not break down even under high temperature and pressure.
The University of California at Riverside did a study where they cooked 27 batches of popcorn in the same heated jojoba oil. The last batch was just as perfect as the first. These unusual properties are unique to jojoba oil because, chemically speaking, jojoba oil is not really an oil at all, but is a liquid wax. Its composition is almost identical to sebum, which is the oil secreted by human sebaceous glands to help to protect the skin from the environment.
Jojoba has a myriad of usages. The cosmetic industry takes advantage of its compatibility to human skin by adding it to shampoos, conditioners, moisturizers, and many other cosmetic products. In medicine, jojoba can be used directly on rashes, cuts, and psoriasis. It may also be used as a lubricant for artificial hearts. Jojoba contains a natural appetite suppressant, which can be used in weight loss products. It has no known side effects. In industry, jojoba is known to be a superior engine lubricant and will cause a car to run 20 to 30 degrees cooler when added to the crankcase oil.
So, if you are interested in a miracle plant from the desert, reach for jojoba in your natural medicine chest.
Welcome back once again to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Thank you so much for joining us today on Progressive Radio Network. This is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse. And I want to thank all the listeners. We had many Natural Medicine Chest listeners and also The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z listeners with us in the field when we did our Chinatown trip, where we spend a day. It's an echo tour for cures in Chinatown. And we do a lot of exciting adventures, such as learning about tongue and pulse diagnosis, learning about edible wild plants, going underground in the bowels of Chinatown and seeing a facility where they actually make extracts from herbal remedies. We have a sit-down sacred Chinatown tea ceremony. And in general, it's a fabulous day, sort of like going on a trip to another country. And we have them regularly, so we're taking registration right now for our next one. We were totally sold out, and many listeners did join in. So we invite you to go to naturalnurse.com under schedule and see the many events that we have all the time. Another event we have coming up is certification courses in natural medicine. And the certification courses are available both online and in the field. In the field, we go out and gather edible and medicinal plants and make them into medicine. And you can find out more at naturalnurse.com. And we also have a fabulous conference that comes around every year. This is our third annual Natural Medicine Conference. And that conference is for health professionals, but the public is also allowed to join in. Health professionals do get 6 CEU credits depending on their profession, such as nurses and chiropractors and acupuncturists and naturopathic physicians. So we have 6 CEU credits available. We have a whole lineup of great speakers, and that's coming in October. So it's a ways off, but every year it has completely filled up. So these are just some of the things I'd like to give you a heads up about so you know they're available. Go to naturalnurse.com under schedules to find out more. And today we have as our guest Mr. Bob Oley. He is part of the Tick-Borne Disease Alliance, And he's been telling us about the problems with tick-borne diseases in our area, and also will offer some solutions in particular about prevention. So thank you so much for being back on board with us today, Bob.
You're very welcome, Ellen.
That
thank
sounds
you.
Much better. That's a much better connection.
Yeah, it is. I apologize for that. I really do.
That's okay. Well, thanks to you and the engineers so that we're all totally back on board right now. And, you know, we'll continue our discussion. So you got interested in this field because, unfortunately, you yourself did get infected and noticed not only the terrible aspects of this illness, but also the difficulty in navigating the medical system and trying to get some treatment. Did you find that that was a problem for you?
Very much so, Ellen, and it's a problem for everyone, generally speaking, unless you happen to be a lucky person, and I'm not sure how lucky you are, but to come down with Lyme disease and have the bullseye rash. A bullseye rash is a telltale sign you have Lyme disease, and if you develop the bullseye rash, then, you know, any doctor you go to will tell you you have Lyme disease and you need to get treated as soon as possible. But
so let me share this with you. I did definitely get bit by a tick, which I was able to find the tick, and it was a deer tick. And I took it off, and I definitely got that bullseye rash a few days later in an area other than where the bite was. But I never came down with any symptoms whatsoever. Of course, I immediately went on an all-natural kind of very aggressive antibiotic therapy routine, as well as using conventional antibiotics immediately when I saw the bullseye rash. And I really did never get any kind of symptoms. So, you know, I wonder about that as well.
You know, Ellen, once you start treatment, there's a good many people believe that you have upwards of a 3-week window to treat and most likely be able to knock out the disease organism. You know, sometimes when you have Lyme disease, despite getting the bullseye rash, you may not get other symptoms for days, weeks, months, even some years after the actual being bitten by a tick. So the key here is, in your case, you really did what you should have done and get prompt treatment because that's the key to this disease. If you don't get prompt treatment for Lyme disease, and as well as some of the other tick-borne diseases, you face the risk of not being able to knock this disease out in a timely manner and having to deal with it for many, many years. People will go to doctors that don't have the bullseye rash and maybe there's 35, 40, 50% of people that actually will get it. And they'll go to our doctor and they'll run all kinds of tests on these people. And because the blood tests are not very good for Lyme disease and as well as some of the other tick-borne diseases, these people will bounce from doctor to doctor to doctor. And I've heard that the average number of doctors somebody will go to before they finally realize they have Lyme disease can be 6 or 7 or 8 specialists. And I myself had CAT scans done. I myself went to all kinds of specialists. No one could figure out that I had Lyme disease. And this is very typical of people. So you yourself, Ellen, are very lucky to get that bullseye rash, as unlucky as you were to be bitten by a tick. And because you took prompt action to treat the disease, you very well may have completely knocked it out of your system. And
these are organisms, and they proliferate, and that's what you're talking about. And sometimes people don't have any sign until they're very advanced and you're getting some of the symptoms such as joint pain, brain fog. What if some of the symptoms that people do experience, because it seems so wide-ranging?
Well, you know, Ellen, when you first, most people will get bitten by a tick generally in the spring and summer months. That's not to say you won't get bitten by a tick during the winter months or fall months, but most people who come down with Lyme disease are bitten when they're outside, when there's more and more ticks in the warmer weather. And people will develop flu-like symptoms very early on with this disease. You know, it's been called the summertime flu. People don't usually get the flu in the summertime, but in this case with Lyme disease, the symptoms are very much flu-like. You have headache, fever, chills, muscle pain, joint pain, sore throat. And then it can progress from that point to other more neurological type symptoms. You can have Bell's palsy, you can have memory loss, you can have trouble concentrated, you can have mood and swings, muscle and joint pain, of course, stomach pain, frequent headaches, ongoing fatigue, and heart palpitations. And then once it progresses beyond that mid stage to a later stage, you know, extreme fatigue, continuing muscle and joint pain, arthritis, you know, lightheadedness, you can have cold hands and feet, skin rashes, sweating, ear ringing. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And Lyme disease is called the new great imitator. It's called that because it mimics so many other diseases. And that's why it's so very hard to diagnose, because you can have well over 100 symptoms for Lyme disease. And most people miss it because in the medical community, because the testing is so very bad. But so those are the kind of symptoms that you'll experience from the very beginning to when it gets really very bad. You can develop, be diagnosed with dementia, Parkinson's disease, ALS, any of these neurodegenerative diseases.
Actually, what a lot of the literature states, and I personally have unfortunately seen in my own patients, is something that is very similar to advanced syphilis.
Absolutely. The dementia, you mean, syphilis is a spirochetal organism, just like the Lyme disease organism is. And the symptoms are very similar in a lot of respects. But the dementia, all the neurological symptoms that you can get with Lyme disease are very similar to syphilis.
They are, and it's quite unfortunate because that's sort of not recognized. And the way people have been put off, they're told that it's psychological. They're giving it antidepressants, which actually makes their overall immune system even less effective. It's very poorly handled.
It is, Ellen, and you know, and I hear, you know, because I'm involved in the Lyme community as I am, I hear so many stories of people that have been told it's psychosomatic, it's in your head, you're looking for attention. This is a very, very serious disease, and unfortunately, the mainstream medical community is not doing its job and properly diagnosing this, because people's lives are being ruined by this disease, and it can infect whole families, and it's a very serious condition that's not going away.
Now let me ask you this: I would like to know your opinion on this. I have also seen it spread through families, and yet sometimes there's. It seems like it might be catching is where I'm going with this. I wonder if that's the case, or if it's just that several members of the family, since they live in the same place, you know, all got individually infected.
I think it's, Alan, more likely that because they live in the same place, they're more likely to be infected. If you live in an area in the suburbs that, let's say you live on a piece of property in a one-acre lot where you have woodlands on your property, and you go out and you use your property, you play, you rake leaves on your property, you use your property as most people use your property. There are some properties that would have more ticks on them than other properties. So, and if you have pets, dogs or cats that go outside a lot, they can bring ticks into the house as well. So, yes, if you see one family member with a tick-borne disease, chances are there's more than one family member that has the disease, only because they're using the same, and they're in the same environment, they're using the same yards, they have the same activities, and they're going to be exposed to tick bites just like the rest of their family members are.
Now, I know your focus is not on treatment. And, in fact, we've had some guests on who use a variety of herbal remedies, because sometimes those antibiotics don't seem to do it, or People have to stay on the antibiotics so long that they're developing resistant strains and all kinds of complications. So we do have other shows where we're talking about protocols for treatment once you have it, but your expertise is focused more on prevention in the first place, which is always the best way to go if we can.
You know, you're absolutely right, Alan. Prevention is the key for Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases, and avoidance is an education or an important component of prevention. You know, if you know areas where there are ticks, and it's pretty much everywhere these days.
Do you know any areas where there are not ticks? I mean, I'm an herbalist, so I'm outside walking in the woods all the time, and I don't. Although I don't see them in Florida, because that's one of the places I live. Are they in Florida, or are they more of a northeastern pest?
They are definitely in Florida. There are, and it's not just the deer tick that you would find in Florida. You've got a few other ticks in Florida as well, such as the Lone Star tick, the American dog tick, the brown dog tick, and another tick called the Gulf Coast tick.
Okay, I'm so happy you're sharing that. In terms of the dog tick, that's one that many people are familiar with. It's a larger tick. It's not that head of the pin thing that's even scarier because you can almost not see it. Do dog ticks also carry these illnesses?
Dog ticks, ticks carry different illnesses. And dog ticks are known for a couple of illnesses. One is Rocky Mountain spotted fever. That's carried by the dog tick. Tularemia, otherwise known as rabbit fever, is carried by the dog tick. And there's another condition called tick paralysis, which is carried by the American dog tick. It's where if a tick is the dog tick is attached, it can release a toxin in your body that causes a paralysis of your body. And it's not very common, but there are certainly cases of it. So the dog tick doesn't carry quite as many diseases as, say, the deer tick or the Lone Star tick might. But you can become infected with the Rocky Mountain spotted fever, like I said, from the bite of a dog tick. And it's a dog tick is easier to spot. That's one good thing about a dog tick. They're bigger than the deer tick. You mentioned the pinhead size of a deer tick. So you're more likely to find a dog tick. A dog tick, in its immature stages, which would be the nymph and larval stage, you're not as likely to, they're not as likely to bite, people. And, they're more likely to bite, small, mammals like, mice and, chipmunks and, other rodents. It's the adult stage of the dog tick, the male and female, that it will aggressively bite a person. And the only good thing about that is that you're more likely to see a dog tick on you than not because of its larger size. It's really the size of like a small apple seed. And, so with the dog tick, you have a better shot of finding one on you and actually being able to pull it off before it has a chance to infect you with, let's say, the Rocky Mountain spotted fever organism or the bacterial organism related to tularemia.
It's really, you know, let me ask you this. I've been, as I said, an herbalist my whole life. I started my career in natural medicine in 1964. That's with a six.
Uh-huh.
So it's many decades ago. And we always walked in the woods. I mean, I was a Girl Scout also. You know, we lived in the woods. We camped. That's always been such a big part of my life. And it doesn't seem that we heard about these diseases. How did they suddenly become so prolific, or is it just that we know more about it now?
Well, it's in part because we know a lot more about them, but it's more so that they're more prolific. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention just this year finally recognized the fact that we have at least 300,000 new cases of Lyme disease every year across the country. And part of the reason we have that, Alan, is because there are far more deer in our environment today than there ever were. And I read a study once that was talking about the state of Connecticut, and they said that in the year 1900, there were basically no deer in the entire state of Connecticut, or very few, because all the land was farmed, the woodlands were cleared, the host that ticks need just weren't there for the ticks to feed on. Well, as the farmland became residential properties, and as the farmland developed into forest land again, the deer population came back with a vengeance. And the deer population is far greater now than it's ever been in years and years and years. So when you were growing up and out in the woods as a Girl Scout and myself as a Boy Scout, you didn't have as many ticks carrying these many diseases because you didn't have as many of the deer in the environment. And you just didn't have the conditions that are so right. It's almost like a perfect storm, Ellen, in terms of these tick-borne diseases today, because of all the deer that are there, because of all the rodents that are there that are carrying the disease. Interestingly enough, if a tick feeds on a deer, the tick will not get a disease from the deer. The tick gets the disease from feeding on a mouse, chipmunk, birds, lizards, squirrels. It picks up the disease organisms and feeding on those vertebrates, but it will not pick it up feeding on a deer. The reason why the deer are so important for ticks and Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases is because the reproductive success of ticks is really can be attributed to deer. They say that 90%, Alan, of the adult deer ticks feed on deer, and they procreate, and then they lay their eggs in the spring, and they can lay 2,000, 3,000 eggs. A dog tick can lay 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 eggs in one batch, and a Lone Star tick can lay 2,000 or 3,000 eggs in one batch. So the deer are important to the reproductive success of all these ticks, and because we have more deer in our environment, you're more likely to find ticks, and you're more likely to find ticks that are infected with these disease organisms.
Well, that's very interesting. So in other words, that's new information for me, and that's why I love doing radio shows, and I love working in this field because there's never an end to learning. Now, what you just said, I don't think I knew before, so let me repeat it and make sure I heard you correctly. You're saying that the deer is not the one that actually infects the tick with the Borrelia or another disease organism.
Correct. You're absolutely correct.
I didn't know that.
No, but the deer is critical because the deer ticks prefer to feed on a larger mammal, and because there's so many deer in our environment these days, you can get literally hundreds of ticks feeding on a deer, hundreds, and a male and female deer tick will mate on a deer. And then the female drops off. And part of the reason that the deer can be such a problem is the deer move the ticks from location to location. Like a tick will be feeding on a deer, a female deer tick. And then that deer is walking through your property and is feeding on your garden, and the ticks drop off the deer. I mean, they feed for adult deer tick will feed for upwards of a week on a deer. It just stays attached to the deer for a week. But once it's fed and it's had its blood meal, it drops off the deer. And if that deer, again, is in your property or on your yard, the tick drops off. And that female tick will lay her eggs in the spring, and wherever that tick is where those new larval ticks will be born. So, again, the deer walk through your property. Wherever you find deer, and you're going to find ticks. And So the deer are key to the reproductive success of ticks, and they're important to this whole, again, I'll use the word perfect storm of this tick-borne diseases that are out there.
Now, what about if people live in a major city, let's say Manhattan, where there's really no deer wandering around? Are they less likely to come down with Lyme disease or these other tick-borne diseases?
If you live in a major city, you're less likely to come down with tick-borne disease if you never leave the city. But if you're in New York City and you visit Central Park, you can get a tick bite in Central Park. If you live in Philadelphia and you visit Fairmount Park, I can guarantee you that you're going to be exposing yourself to infections. It's when you leave the confines of the city that that you're going to become exposed to ticks. And where you have park-like settings, like Central Park, Fairmount Park in Philadelphia, any place in the woods, any place in the field, you know, if you go to soccer games, you go to baseball games, people go for their children and grandchildren, and you know, you have a lot of woodlands that are around, that surround soccer fields or surround baseball fields. And you know, when I was had my children growing up, we used to go to soccer games, and we used to sit on the edge of the field. There's always be like a shady area, woods behind us. Well, those are some of the worst areas you have for ticks. And, you know, anyone who's playing on a soccer field and or chases a soccer ball out into the woods, you know, you're going to be exposed to ticks. So the urban environment is a safer environment to be in, but as soon as you take advantage of the parks that are in the urban environment, as soon as you leave that urban environment, if you live in New York City and you go out to the Hamptons, well, guess what? You know, you're going to be exposed to tick-borne diseases like you've never been exposed before, and it's... And out in the Hamptons, you have a tick called the Lone Star tick, which, you know, is a more aggressive tick than the deer tick, and has a different set of diseases that you can get from the Lone Star tick. So, yeah, the urban environment, if you were never to leave it, is a very safe environment to be in as far as tick-borne diseases are concerned, and it's a good point you make.
Wow. So basically, what we're going to do is take a little break right here and have some station promos from Progressive Radio Network. And when we come back, Bob, we'd love to discuss your very well thought out sort of being aggressively protective when you do enter these natural environments to avoid getting bitten by a tick in the first place. That's something
Sounds
that people
good.
Really need to be aware of. So we will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Welcome back once again to another edition right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we love to hear from you. You can find us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse, and we look forward to your comments. And you can join us on ground. Go to naturalnurse.com, look at schedule, and you'll see where we're giving our various lectures and presentations. Or look at education if you're interested in online learning in every topic in natural medicine, and you can get a certification in the field of your choice. Today, we're very happy to have as our guest Mr. Bob Oley, and he is with the Tick-Borne Disease Alliance. You can find out more by going online to tdballiance.org, tdballiance.org. By the way, this show, like all of our shows here on Progressive Radio Network, will be archived. So if there's something that you think might be of interest to a friend of yours, or if you want to get the link to get in touch with us or our guests, just go to the archives, listen to the show, and the description of the show will be there with the contact information. And we have with us Bob, who is very knowledgeable in environmental wellness, and is sharing with us today his concern and his superior advice in terms of how to avoid getting a tick bite in the first place. So let's talk about some of the ways that you've developed that people can use so that they still can enjoy the outside and yet save themselves from this horrendous disease.
Thank you, Ellen. There are lots of things people can do as opposed to shutting themselves indoors and never going outside.
Which I know people who have done.
Do.
Yeah, I know people who do that.
But there are lots of things you can do. If you're, and I'll start out with some simple things. If you're walking through the woods and you're walking along a trail, you know, stay in the center of the trail where you're not going to be having brush that will be hitting your skin. Ticks, by the way, and this will tie in very nicely to the prevention. Ticks, by the way, do something called questing. They'll go on a leaf close to the ground. They'll go on a blade of grass, and they just wait for somebody to come by. And when they when that person comes by, whether it's their skin that touches the tick or their clothing, the tick will attach, and it can attach very quickly. And the tick picks up a scent of carbon dioxide, picks up heat, picks up vibration. A tick is very smart in how it survives, and it can pick up all these things. And so when you come near it, it kind of gets in a ready position, and it will latch onto you very quickly, latch onto your clothing, and start crawling upward on your body. And so avoidance of these ticks is key if you can. But if you can't avoid them by because you're on the center of a path and you're walking through the grass or whatever, there's some things you can do. You can wear clothing that's treated, and I don't know whether I should say this on this show, but treated with a chemical called permethrin. If there was a natural element out there to treat clothing, I would certainly recommend it. But right now, the chemical that's out there is called permethrin. People treat their clothing with it. They treat their shoe wear with it. They treat their socks. They treat their hats, backpacks.
Oh, wait a minute. This is like you wear your regular clothes, and then this is something that you would spray on?
Correct. You would spray it on yourself. And in terms of your clothing, it will repel and kill ticks very nicely and without any adverse effects to you. And if you spray it on your clothing, it'll last through 5 or 6 washings. If you spray it on your footwear, it'll last for upwards of 4 to 6 weeks on your footwear. People that go outside a lot and are enjoying the great outdoors, clothing is probably the most important thing other than avoidance, Alan, that you can do to fight off ticks. And you can also buy clothing that's pre-treated. You can get, there's various retailers, L.L. Bean, Columbia, Zorel, REI, that sell pre-treated clothing. And it's a process that was developed in 2003 and actually approved by the Environmental Protection Agency in 2003. And if you have clothing that's pre-treated, that's clothing you don't treat yourself, it'll be really last through 70 or more washings, or really the life of the garment. So if you wear this clothing that's you treat yourself or it's pre-treated, you can feel pretty comfortable that any tick crawling on that clothing will fall off and die. I myself have pants that I wear outside when I garden, and it's the pants are pre-treated with permethrin, and I'll put ticks on those pants, and I've watched them crawl up my leg. And they only go like 8 or 9 inches, and they fall off and die. This has been around for many years. In fact, the Department of Defense, it's an important part of their chemical protection system for the troops that are in the United States and overseas. All their clothing in the U.S. Army now, and I think the Marines, is all pre-treated with permethrin. And they're not just concerned about ticks. I mean, they're concerned about mosquitoes and a whole variety of other insects. But wearing clothing that's treated, whether you treat it yourself or get clothing that's pre-treated, is really key. There's a company in North Carolina out of Greensboro called Insect Shield. They developed this technique, again, in 2003. And it's used in lots and lots of clothing today. And you can, if your children are going to camp, you can send your camp clothing to this company in North Carolina. It's the only place in the United States that does this, and called Insect Shield. And they'll treat the clothing and send it back to you looking the exact same way as when you sent it. But it now has the protection for the life of that garment against ticks and as well as other insects. So people can take advantage of that, and they can feel somewhat safer than sending their kids outside if they have clothing that's been treated. It's really key to the whole prevention process. And the other thing is, were you wearing shorts or where you have exposed skin, insect repellents on your exposed skin is also key. There's some natural repellents that are out there that consist of essential oils that can be very good, probably the best one out there, Ellen, is something called lemon eucalyptus. That was approved by the Centers for Disease Control. It's one of four insect repellents that they recommend for ticks. There are some others like DEET, picaridin, another chemical called IR3535 that are chemicals that are also out there. But the lemon eucalyptus works very well.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because of course, as you stated, of course, our audience is usually interested more in natural products, but.
Right.
I think you point out well, you know, when you're deciding what to do here, since Lyme disease is such a difficult thing to get rid of if you do get it, that you do need to sort of measure the risk-benefit ratio, especially the pre-treated clothes. Do they have this chemical then on the inside, which is going to touch your skin? Well, if you just spray it yourself, you can limit it to the outside of the clothing rather than touching your own skin with it.
It's on the pre-treated clothing, Ellen. It's on the inside and outside. But
right.
If you're spraying your own clothing, you should spray the inside as well, because any tick that's crawling up your leg, let's say it starts at your shoe and it's crawling up, you're wearing shorts, crawls up your leg, it's tending to crawl to the moisture area of your body, and it'll be crawling most likely on the inside of your whatever you may be wearing. Now, if you happen to be wearing pants and you have your pants tucked in to your socks, then you know the likelihood is that when the tick starts crawling low at the lower elevation, it'll work its way up on the outside. But it's important to be outside and inside. But there's been so much testing with the permethrin, not only by the EPA but by other groups, and it's been tens of thousands of people that are wearing these type of clothing without any adverse reaction. It's really as safe as anything can be. And
I know you mentioned also DEET, and DEET has a pretty aggressive profile of possible negative effects in and of itself.
DEET is one of several chemical repellents that people can put on their skin. You would never put it on your clothing. It's not made for clothing. You would put it on your skin. And DEET, I used to use DEET myself. I don't use DEET anymore because I don't like the idea of my skin absorbing the DEET. But I tend to use, like I said, lemon eucalyptus. And there's a couple more out there that are essential oils that work to varying degrees. The most important thing about tick repellent, Ellen, for the audience, is it has to say on the repellent container whether or not it repels ticks, and it has to say how long. Most of the essential oils, unfortunately, like peppermint oil, rosemary, citronella oil, lemongrass oil, the problem with these oils are that they will repel ticks and mosquitoes as well as other insects to varying degrees. And with the essential oils, they only last on your skin for so long. They may only work for 30 minutes to an hour before they no longer effective. Whereas something like lemon eucalyptus, generally that'll work for 4 to 6 hours, as opposed to, like I said, 30 minutes or an hour. So DEET is something that, you have to be careful about. And, there are other alternatives to DEET out there. And there's some of those certainly are the essential oils that are very effective. The other thing I should throw out, when people are coming back from an outdoor activity, you can have ticks on your clothing. One good way to get rid of any tick on your clothing is to throw it in a clothes dryer for 15 minutes, 20 minutes on high heat, and that will kill any tick that's on that clothing. So if you're out gardening, if you're out hiking, if you're out playing a sport, come in, and when you come into the house, take your clothes off and put them in the clothes dryer. It'll kill any tick that's on them. The ticks will be just will dry out and die. And it doesn't take very long for this to happen. Putting clothes in a clothes washing machine on high heat, on high water temperature setting will not kill the ticks. The dryer will kill the ticks. So that's one good way you can prevent ticks from coming into your house that are on your clothing that haven't yet attached to you. And the other thing that's very important here, Alan, are tick checks. You know, once you do an outdoor activity, again, whether it's in the woods or wherever, coming home after that activity and carefully checking yourself for ticks. They're very hard to see. They're very hard to find. As we stated earlier in the program, a dog tick is easier to find than a deer tick. But you need to check yourself for ticks and that of your family members. So it's wearing clothing that's pre-treated, or you treat yourself with permethrin. It's wearing insect repellents. It's doing tick checks when you after your activities. It's putting your clothes in the clothes dryer when you come in. And it's being vigilant for symptoms. When you start developing any kind of symptoms that don't make sense, like the summertime flu symptoms, you really need to consider that maybe you've been bitten by a tick, especially if you've been out in an outdoor environment.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. Fascinating information. And, you know, you're raising a little bit of an alarm, but that's a good thing, because so much better to be proactive with prevention than try treatment protocols, which are often less than effective. This is not an easy thing to get rid of and quite severe. So I want to thank you so much for being our guest today, Bob. What is the best way for people to find out more about your topic?
The best way is that the Tick-Borne Disease Alliance has a great website. You mentioned it earlier, www.tbdalliance.org. It's a great website. There's another good website out there, Ellen. It's put out by the University of Rhode Island. It's www.tickencounter.org. It's a great information on ticks, and there's my own website, which, you know, if you don't mind, I'll throw that out. It's www.boboley.com. And any the Tick-Borne Disease Alliance website, the Tick Encounter website, and my own website, you can get all kinds of good information on just about every aspect of the disease, from prevention to treatment to that. And it's thank you so much for having me on. It's a topic that's of a very serious nature, and one that needs to be discussed more and more, and the information needs to get out there. Thank you, Alan.
Okay, thank you too, and thank you, listeners, for joining us once again for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, at naturalnurse.com and Facebook, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.